President Biden is making a pivot from the pandemic to the deepening security crisis in Afghanistan. The Taliban captured three more provincial capitals in the past day. They are now closing in on Kabul, where the U.S. embassy is located.
And now 3,000 American troops are en route to Kabul to whisk out embassy workers. The staffers have been instructed to destroy documents and other sensitive equipment. Now, last month, President Biden said combat troops would be gone from Afghanistan before the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks that prompted the U.S. invasion in the first place. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Margaret Tolov is managing editor at Axios. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, great to be with you.
And we've got Maya King. She covers national politics for Politico. Hey, Maya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Margaret, we're going to start with you. On Tuesday, the president was asked, considering everything we just talked about and described, if he regretted his decision to pull out of Afghanistan.
We're going to continue to keep our commitment, but I do not regret my decision.
Does that ring true, Margaret? What's the thinking inside the White House right now?
It does ring true for how President Biden personally feels about this. There are some divisions, certainly inside his government, if you expand it out of his inner circle in the White House, and you look to, you know, people working everywhere from the State Department and USAID to, of course, the Pentagon and the intelligence community. But Biden has been crystal clear and unwavering about this. And that has been, those have been the public statements from the team and the private statements from the team as well. In fact, folks, you know, behind the scenes who my colleague Jonathan Swan and I talked to this week described a situation where there was just a feeling sort of inside the Pentagon and those communities that it was sort of futile to try to push for any other outcome because Biden had completely made up his mind and it was unchanging.
So the White House is confident here behind the scenes and also in front of the microphone. But it's interesting to hear the language that they're using. The Pentagon is not calling this a non-combatant evacuation operation, even though it looks like one, because it would signal in an emergency. And it's not being called a combat mission either. So how sensitive is all of this for the administration? Does the Biden team think that it could be politically damaged if this situation does deteriorate, Maya?
I think so. And I think you can look at the optics of this as a clear indicator that they're really trying to do some damage control here. It's also important to note, of course, that this was a goal. Removal of troops from Afghanistan was a goal of also President Trump. So this is kind of something that I think both parties have been thinking about doing. I think one thing that's front of mind for a number of folks within the administration and outside of it is how the region will look and how things will turn out as we get closer to this 20th anniversary of 9/11. Of course, the plan right now is to have all troops out of Afghanistan by the end of this month. But I think just given how quickly the situation has advanced and how rapidly the region has deteriorated already, it's kind of hard to see how this, as we get closer to this anniversary, that things might not look pretty bleak.
Now, just briefly, Margaret, just before we move on to infrastructure, I just want to ask you, as far as the White House, given what we're seeing now, does the White House have any good options here on Afghanistan? Margaret?
Yeah, I mean, look, right now this... Yep, yeah, I'm sorry, can you hear me?
We've still got you here. Margaret, if you can hear me, I was just asking you if the president has any good options now.
I can hear you. Are you able to hear me?
Okay, yeah. Yes, we can hear you. How about Maya? You there, Maya?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, why don't you jump in quickly, please?
Sure. And I think the short answer is really that they're running out of good options at this point, because it's either, you know, pulling troops out and watching this region, you know, kind of rapidly deteriorate, or try to save face, but also contradict yourself. As Margaret said it earlier, you know, this could actually look like sort of the administration going against its earlier promises of not only getting out of this region, but stabilizing it as well.
Okay. Well, let's see if we can get Margaret's connection worked out. In the meantime, we'll move on to infrastructure. Trouble brewing in the House of Representatives on this issue. Last night, 9 moderate Democrats sent a letter to the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, saying they would not vote for that $3 trillion budget resolution that she supports unless the smaller one, the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure deal that passed in the Senate this week, gets signed into law first. Here's what New Jersey Congressman Josh Gottheimer told us and Scott earlier today.
This is about our crumbling roads and bridges and tunnels, historic investments in mass transit and water infrastructure and electric vehicles and climate resiliency and all the things that we're desperate for to stay competitive as a country. And, you know, the idea that we would wait an unnecessary delay for no reason makes no sense to us.
Here's the thing. Progressives are saying the exact opposite thing. They want the big deal passed before the bipartisan one. Margaret, I think we have you back. The technical term here is what, political pickle or something for Nancy Pelosi? Well, how's she going to navigate this?
Yeah, snafu, terrible Friday, migraine August, you know. It's you know how sometimes in politics, this is what Biden used to call the kabuki dance? People say stuff, but you know what's really going to happen in the end. This doesn't appear to actually be one of those moments. So, look, I'll say this. Pelosi has been pretty clear that she thinks one can't go before the other because of where the majority of the caucus and where the progressives in the caucus are. So in the absence of a shift from her, my working assumption, my reporting working assumption is that she still does not want to do what this group of nine is asking her to do. But I think what we're seeing in the immediate hours since this letter is a bit of a pause to try to recalibrate and see where things really stand. And I do think that this group of nine, the more moderate group, also tend to be the more pragmatic group in terms of how do you get what you want out of this. So if they get to do the part where they're saying all this stuff and talking about fiscal, you know, being fiscally careful and trying for bipartisanship, that's something important for them politically. And maybe there are other things that they all want. Maybe there's somewhere to negotiate. Pelosi needs to figure out how to hold this together and which group is most likely to have something they're willing to make a deal on. And I think that's where she is right now.
Holding this together, Margaret, I just want to stay with you. For the regular American out there, what does this tell us about the Democrats? They control both ends of Capitol Hill and the White House. They're also notorious for internal spats here. Can they show they can govern?
Well, I do think, you know, we'll see. But I think there's two ways to look at the story. One is, yes, the entire thing could fall apart because people can't agree. But the other way to look at it is then Biden is poised now to lead his party to, at a minimum, a massive infrastructure deal that would do decades worth of improvements on roads and bridges and all that standard stuff. And that on the larger end would certainly be the closest thing to a New Deal since the actual New Deal. So I think, you know, there are two kind of parallel narratives and storylines. And one is, are Democrats going to do the Charlie Brown with the football at the last minute? And the other is like, oh my goodness, nobody, you know, we've been talking about Infrastructure Week for 25 years and some version of something big is probably going to happen. I think that's where we still are, but the Charlie Brown football thing could still happen.
Okay, let's move over to the question of the census now. And Maya, I want to ask you about the numbers that came out yesterday. We saw that the U.S. population the last decade has become less white, has become more diverse, notably in politically important places. Florida, Texas, Nevada, Georgia. Are we seeing a purpling of these places? I don't know what purple and blue makes, but is that happening here?
Well, I think it's a purpling if you can immediately assume that these populations, this growing number of racial minorities, are going to vote Democratic. Then I suppose that it is sort of a purpling. And you also see, which is another good sign for Democrats, this rapid growth in big cities over the last 10 years, which have always been Democratic domains that Republicans are looking also to cut into. But I think your point is right, especially in the Sun Belt states and these battleground states that Democrats absolutely need if they want to hold the House and expand their majority in the Senate, thinking about Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, Arizona, which isn't quite the Sun Belt, but still kind of in that range of states that Democrats will need.
Oh, I live in Arizona. It's the Sun Belt. I'll say that.
Yeah, and I'm thinking a lot about the Deep South as well, where Democrats are hoping to make inroads. Of course, there are two big roadblocks to this. One, the fact that the GOP controls redistricting in a majority of these battleground states and will be the party that writes these district lines in the next couple of months here that were most likely to be favorable to them. And also in these Sun Belt states, they're starting to pass, especially in Republican-controlled state legislatures, laws that would limit legitimate turnout among a lot of the groups that we're saying or that we're seeing have grown substantially in population over the last 10 years. Black voters, Latino voters, Asian Americans. These are all demographics that Democrats absolutely need to win in 2022, but the Republicans are certainly, they have in their toolbox just a lot more at their disposal to really make these, make this still something that would be advantageous to them.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, we have less than a minute, so real quick, do you think redistricting could kick Democrats out of control in the House?
Oh, yeah, for sure it could. The census results are promising in two states for Democrats, New York and Illinois, which are their only two like numeric paths to kind of try to crush or arrest this the oncoming year. But in general, the census findings are a silver lining to a fairly crappy year for Democrats.
Margaret Talov at Axios and Maya King at Politico. Thanks to you both very much.